watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. Sego to my Haudenosaunee brothers listening from Auburn. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. On the program, we return to our ongoing lecture series with economic historian Doug Dowd. This week, a history of U.S. militarism and its ultimately economic function, from the birth of the nation to the present. Dowd asks, were America's wars necessary? And if so, necessary for what? Then we'll hear from students involved in the counter-recruitment movement, working to get military recruiters off their campuses and educate their fellow students about the realities of military service.
No fat rich man's pony can overtake you. There's not a rider from the east to the west to hold you alive in this darkness and midnight when the pot-bellied beasts chase their unwelcome guests.
Professor Doug Dowd is author of many books on the economics of politics and the politics of economics. He has also been on the front lines of many historic movements and events of the 20th century. Every year, he gives a free course for the public on the real-world effects of capitalist economics and its supporting politics. We've been broadcasting this year's class series on the program since this spring. The talk we're going to hear tonight was given on July 4th in San Francisco.
You know, we held this class tonight, on the 4th of July, for one specific reason. As some of you guessed, I think, a long time ago, and you, for some reason, really continue to come anyway, I'm supported not by my pensions, which are inadequate, but by the FBI. And so this was a test to see which of the people in this class would come here on the 4th of July, and you're all going to be arrested after the class, okay? Except me. So tonight, this is in effect chapter 4 of the unpublished book, which I think will remain unpublished, which is called U.S. Militarism, Talking Peace, Making War. Maybe it's a kind of arrogance on my part, but what I think is my obligation, given the fact that I've been reading and studying about these things for more than half a century, well over half a century, I think is to try to give you just a little depth to just how much you should be angry about the United States with respect to militarism, just how awful we really are. And it isn't just Iraq, and it isn't just Vietnam, and it isn't just Korea, and it isn't just Cuba, and so on and so on. It's us. The U.S. is one of the most militaristic societies in all of history, and most especially is that so when we take into account something very, very significant. We are the society of all the major societies. When I speak of the major, I mean the capitalist societies, the rich societies in the world. All of the societies that one can think of, read about, ours has the least justification for ever going to war, till World War II, when we were attacked. Okay. But even that can be explored. There's never been any reason for us. I mean, you can see why the Germans, the French, the Italians, the Japanese, the Chinese, everyone, they're all surrounded by all kinds of potential or actual enemies, and even more than that, except for the United States, and in a very, very lesser sense now, China. There's never been any country in the world whose resources have been so ample in every respect. There's never been any need for us to be aggressive toward others because we always had everything that we needed. until we get into the post-World War II era, when the kind of technologies that are used now, especially for military planes, required things like titanium. Well, God was unkind to the United States. It didn't give us any titanium. But, you know, it's just little things like this that we haven't had. We've never had any excuse. We've had lots of excuses, lots of reasons we've given for war. But unlike all other countries, there's never been any need for it. There's never been any decent rationale for it. We've never been on the defensive, except when we brought it upon ourselves. And at the same time, there's another characteristic we have, which makes us very, very dangerous. We're very dangerous because we've been so isolated, so difficult to attack until Pearl Harbor, and even that was a screwball thing. I mean, the Japanese couldn't follow up on that. That was sort of like 9/11, you understand? They dropped bombs on Pearl Harbor, and they couldn't do much more than that at that time. As soon as they tried to do it, we could recover, arm ourselves, and so on, and beat the shit out of them, really beat the shit out of them. It took a long time, and I was part of that, and I know about that very well. I was in that war, but we could do it. Because war is a matter of production, you know, that's what it is. People and production. But the other thing is that so important in terms of why the United States is such a dangerous country to the rest of the world is that war has never hurt us. It scratched us, you understand? It scratched us, but it's never maimed us. And we're the only country which has never really been seriously damaged by war. Now, if you take the 58,000 people who were killed, and U.S. men and women, few of them, who were killed in Vietnam, and take their families, in other words, and multiply that by 10, you have 580,000 people, 1/10 of them dead, the other 90% feeling bad about it. And then you compare that with what happened to the people of Southeast Asia. There were 3 million Vietnamese killed, Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians. And then after the war was over, Cambodians, and we were responsible for the deaths in Cambodia. We don't have any sense. How many of you know anyone? How many of you had anyone in your family who was killed in a war? Nobody. Nobody. So as a pal of mine, Cornell, the only guy I really got along well with there, Jan Morse was his name, used to say, Doug, he says, you know what's wrong with us? He says, we don't hate war enough. That's very important. Because if you talk to the average Italian, the average French person, the average Brit, the average German, the average Japanese, the average anybody, they've all got misery hanging from them because of war. And it isn't just that somebody was killed. It's multiply that by 3 or 4. Somebody was wounded badly. Somebody's life was devastated. And their own lives were disrupted. Millions of people disrupted. Millions of people. Nothing like that. If you look at World Wars I and II, World War I caused 10 million deaths in Europe alone. World War II caused 60 million deaths in Europe alone. 30 million of them were in the Soviet Union. The official figures of the United Nations were 28 million, and they've now increased that to 30 million. Half of the 60 million were killed in the Soviet Union. And then you ask, what was happening to those who weren't killed? Their lives were just so completely disrupted, devastated, and everything just went to pieces. And it took years and years for them to ever recover, not just physically, not just economically, inwardly, because of the losses, because of the destruction, because of the horror of it all. What horror happened in the United States during World War II? The horror was that women started to drive buses and get jobs in factories. That was the horror. And blacks began to get jobs in factories. That was the only horror at all. Otherwise, it was one of the best times in history for the United States, except for the 450,000 or so who were killed, and 3 or 4 times that wounded, and their families, 450,000. I think it was less?
I think it was 350.
Maybe 350, give or take 100,000. We're still talking hundreds of thousands instead of millions, okay? So here we are. Moreover, when we look at our history, and you have to keep this in mind, what I'm talking about, I think is very important to keep in mind in terms of the infantile attitude of the average American toward war, or infantile is not as good a word as the teenage attitude toward war, as it's sort of something like a game, is something that is great. If our side wins, if our side loses, well, our side never loses. Or to put it differently, when we have lost, we don't know we've lost. We lost in Korea. We lost in Vietnam. But if you ask people in the United States, how many wars have we lost? They'd say none. because we don't acknowledge that we lost, okay? We're children about war, and kids like to play war. Remember when you were a kid, you liked to play war. So we're dangerous, really dangerous. And we started out that way. I cannot settle in myself this part of our history, what we did once we became or started to become a nation, what we did to the millions of people whom we called Indians, after Columbus calling them Indians, which none of them ever called themselves, none of them. Indians, because Columbus thought he discovered India. There was a nice piece in the Times op-ed today. Did any of you read the op-ed page on the Iroquois on the Times today? New York Times was good. Had to do with the kind of people, the majority of the tribes in the eastern continental United States would be still today, given half a chance. The Iroquois nation was a combination of tribes, but their power extended north, Canada south, all the way down to practically to the Florida, and from the Atlantic west out to as far as Kansas. Go get the Times in the library and read this thing. It's a half-page article. It's a big article by a historian of the American Indians. Not himself an American Indian. He's a professor someplace. You believe in democracy? You should see what they believed in. They really believed in democracy. You believe in peace? They believed in the things that we would like to see on our society. And this was the way, as you know, if you read Howard Zinn's People's History, the very first page is Columbus's note about what the Indians were. Very gentle people. He's talking about the Caribbean, of course, but very gentle, generous, loving people, you understand? And we massacred these people. We didn't just massacre them. We destroyed their culture. We pushed them. We jailed them. We gave concentration camps to them and called them reservations. And now what we're doing is letting them have gambling casinos. And so on and so on. What we did to those people, there were 100 million people like that in the Western Hemisphere in 1600. 1900, there were 10 million. That's what you call 9 times decimation. Now, they weren't all in Northern America. They were in the whole Western Hemisphere. But what we were doing in the North, the Spaniards and the Portuguese and so on were doing in the South, and the French and the Dutch and the British and so on and so on. And it wasn't all bang, bang, bang. A lot of it was diseases that were carried from Europe that couldn't be resisted in the Western Hemisphere. But that's what we did. We reduced that population one way or another from 100 to 10 million, just as we, the Americans in North America, reduced the buffalo population from, and I'm using Department of Agriculture figures now, from in 1800, from 60 million buffalo to 1900, 1,500 buffalo. And if you read the history of how that happened, it didn't happen, and the buffalo were, of course, at the center of the livelihood and, in a certain sense, of the culture of, quote, the Indians. And we knew it when we were helping to abolish the buffalo, because in doing so, we were weakening the Indian culture, weakening their economy, and so on and so on. How did we do it? We did it all kinds of ways. But one of the ways we did it was very American. And what we're doing about it now is very American. What we did as the trains were created going from east to west, building the trains, as the tracks were laid, they also put cars being pulled across the plains, across the country, with benches on the side. And men could get on there with their rifles, and as the trains went across the plains, they could shoot the buffalo. Okay? And the buffalo, of course, are sort of standing there like this. And that's heroism for you. And they've changed that now. Now you can go, you citizens of the United States can go to Yosemite, to Yellowstone National Park, and for $250, you can have your photograph taken as you shoot a buffalo. Okay? But it costs you $250. It must be worthwhile, or it wouldn't cost that much. You understand? And the other thing we're doing is having buffalo burgers, because the buffalo is coming back slowly but surely. So now we have about 20,000 buffalo. And so there's something wrong with a people like this. We grew up this way as a nation, as a people. We grew up this way from the beginning. The Puritans come over, and for one of the next thing you know that they're trying to do is to see to it that some people are burned at the stake and the other people are made free to buy slaves, and so on and so on. I mean, the Puritans were the very people who were at the very center of the city on the hill, which is where the slave trade had its origins. Merchants, not plantation owners, merchants, capitalists, were buying and selling the slaves, and so on. And, of course, all the death and the destruction was. So what I'm trying to say when we talk about war, militarism, the United States, you're talking about a character, deep, 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 deep character defect. Okay? You're talking about a pathological characteristic, which has come to be so normal that we don't even think of it as being there. It's what we make heroes of these people. What are our films about? When I was a kid, the films were heroizing these murderous swine. And I was one of those who watched it and probably at the time thought, wow, you know, these fucking cowboys were murderers. Murderers. The Wild West was an assassin's park. And we heroize these people, idolize them. So when it comes to war, what the hell? Now, if you want to read about this, and you should want to read about it, I mean, I'm just talking, but I'm talking out of books, okay? One of the best things you can read is William Appleman Williams's Empire, what is it? Well, in any case, it's Empire something, something, something. William Appleman Williams is a very interesting guy to know about because he was a graduate of Annapolis, okay? Went through World War II and came out of it, started becoming an academic, Midwest, Wisconsin, and the war, plus probably some kind of decency along with energy, got him to become a very, 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 very good historian. In fact, he founded something like a school of left history. Empire is a Way of Life is the name of his book. And much of the history that you've read, if you've read much history, that is worth reading, is written by people who worked under William Appleman Williams. His first book was called The Contours of American History. It's a stunner. Not a single footnote in it. Okay? He decided it's all bullshit anyway, but he wouldn't talk that way. It's all bullshit, all his footnotes. Either you trust me or you don't. But now I put in footnotes because I want people to be able to go and read something, okay? The references, so they can go on and read it. So The Contours of American History, he takes U.S. history and he starts, let's say, from 1650 and goes to 1750. And then he goes from 1725 to 1825. And then he goes from 1800 to, you understand, he keeps linking them like this. And it's a very marvelous, penetrating way of understanding how the historical process goes. And everything he's talking about, very calm, he's not like me, not a blowhard like me, he's very calm and collected and knows what he's talking about and so on. And he wrote Empire as a Way of Life. And then he wrote, he wrote so many different books. But an Empire is a Way of Life. What he does is to take the U.S. governmental statistics on wars, U.S. wars. You understand? He doesn't say, I found these. He takes the government and then he inquires into those wars. And he finds between 1800 and 1944, he finds 154 wars in the United States, almost all of them undeclared wars, okay? Almost all of them in the name of protecting somebody or protecting something or respect, and so on and so on and so on and so on. One after another. All of them have the same flavor to them that the war in Iraq has to them. Something we wanted, so we went and took it. Disgusting. You should.
Under some false reason.
Pardon? Oh, always with some reasons. Yeah. I got an email just yesterday from Dan Ellsberg, which is an article of his that appeared in the L.A. Times a couple of days ago. This was an op-ed thing of his in the L.A. Times. It's July 3rd. I'm quoting him now. President Bush's explanation Tuesday night for staying the course in Iraq evoked in me a sense of familiarity, but not nostalgia. I had heard virtually all of his themes before, almost word for word, in speeches delivered by three presidents I worked for. Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, and wrote the speeches for. Okay? And he goes on in there about what he said in those speeches. Drafting a speech on the Vietnam War for Defense Secretary Robert S. McNamara in July of 1965. This is Ellsberg drafting the speech for McNamara. Okay? Because all these big shots have their speeches written by somebody else. Ellsberg was writing the speeches for McNamara, Nixon, and Johnson before he decided to turn in the Pentagon Papers, okay, which is another set of stories. The task was to rationalize and motivate continued public support for a hopelessly stalemated, unnecessary war our president had lied us into. You wonder if there's anything like Iraq and Vietnam together. Looking back on my draft, I find I used the word terrorist about our adversaries. This is in 1965. Okay? To explain to the same effect as Bush, I felt the need for a global threat to explain the scale of effort we faced. I felt China was better suited as our real adversary, which is such bullshit because China and Vietnam hate each other. They've been fighting each other for over 1,000 years, okay, than North Vietnam. Just as Bush focuses on Al-Qaeda rather than Iraq's nationalists. There was a clarion call for mobilizing the reserves to support an open-ended escalation of troops by Johnson, as military commanders had urged. But Johnson lied about it, and so on, he goes on about that. So when he gets down to his speech, and he has to explain why they're still having a little bit of trouble in 1965, he says, "We are being tested," I wrote, he says. "We are being tested. Have we the guts, the grit, the determination to stick with a frustrating, bloody, difficult course as long as it takes to see it through?" That's Ellsberg, Daniel Ellsberg. And Ellsberg was, as you know, a Marine captain in Vietnam and has written about it. You should read his book called Secrets, probably sold here, in which you'll see what he evolved from being a gung-ho Marine captain to becoming someone who, in turning in the Pentagon Papers, could have been executed. The very least he would have had Nixon not up is a life sentence in prison, and he knew it. So this, he has some quite good characters moving around in that body of his that acted like a shit heel for so many years. Let's talk about the Korean War for just a minute, and then the Vietnam War for just 2 minutes, and then we'll talk about the Iraqi War. But how many of you have any questions about, did we have to get involved in Korea? I'm not trying to get happy cheerleading yes or no's. I'm saying, do any of you have serious wondering about, well, maybe Korea was necessary? Maybe it was necessary? After all, the Soviet Union and all that jazz. Do any of you seriously believe it was a necessary war? Because a lot of people, a lot of very, very good people, well-informed people, think it was a necessary war. It's very easy to think that. Because after all, the Soviet Union, North Korea, South Korea, so on. And it's just interesting to look into the background, I might say that the very best books on that are by a guy named Cummings, C-U-M-I-N-G-S, and he did this a scholarly study on it, published by Princeton University Press, and then he and another guy did a popular study on it. And you can get the whole story of Korea from him, isn't it? It just wipes out the necessity for the war, the whole thing. But I would just give you one little quote from Chalmers Johnson, who used to be with the State Department, who talks about the background of that war. This is from Lefebvre, who's written a very good book on the subject, Walter Lefebvre. "Japanese armies, according to the Soviet-American agreement, were disarmed." This is as the war ended, the Japanese war ended. "Japanese armies, according to the Soviet-American agreement, in 1945, were disarmed north of the 38th parallel by Russia, south of it by the United States. Lengthy conferences failed to unify the nation, for neither the Soviets nor the Americans wanted to chance the possibility that a unified Korea, which it was, which it had been, would move into the opposing camp." Now, there were real differences between the North and the South, but they weren't North-South differences. They were differences that were political differences, okay? Which more of a left thing in the North, more of a right thing. As would happen later in Vietnam with the 17th parallel, the dividing line cut across and separated natural areas of geography, culture, and climate. The foreseeable result was considerable confusion and conflict, and by the late 1940s, military incursions by Koreans from both sides, dump like this. There had never been that line before historically. Okay, it was created by the Soviet Union and the United States, both of them fearing each other, and I might add, the United States very, very powerful, and the Soviet Union very, very weak. I remind you of something I said a few minutes ago, or was it a day ago? 30 million were killed in the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was flattened by World War II. We were strengthened by World War II in every way, economically, socially, militarily, politically. It was building up to civil war. Each side repeatedly crossed the border to the other with military intent. That's coming from Cummings. The rationale for the U.S. armed intervention was the stated need to respond to an invasion from the north. However, the facts for preceding months had provided equal justification for both sides. The Soviet Union and the United States, each in its own ways, took steps to expand geographically. The former in Czechoslovakia, the Soviet Union, the U.S. and Korea. Czechoslovakia had been occupied by the Germans. Korea had been occupied by the Japanese. The respected Asian scholar Chalmers Johnson tells us what happened. Both countries now underwent transformations into colonies of the victors of World War II. At about the time of the communist coup d'etat in Prague in 1948, right-wing forces in the southern half of divided Korea, then under control of the United States, were slaughtering, this is in the southern half of Korea, right-wing forces were slaughtering at least 30,000 dissident peasants. Part of a process by which Syngman Rhee's, appointed by us, Syngman Rhee's puppet regime in South Korea consolidated its power. A government every bit as unpopular as Gottwald's Stalinist government in Czechoslovakia. Gottwald and Rhee were prototypes of the faceless bureaucrats the Soviets and the Americans would use for the next 40 years to govern their captive nations. And for the, as I ask in this as I go on, and I won't go on now, nobody ever asks themselves, suppose the Soviet Union and the United States had let the Koreans be themselves. 3 million Koreans were killed. 1 million Chinese were killed. 28,000 or so Americans were killed in the Korean War. Korea has never been the same. Now you've got this guy up in the north, the son of the other guy up in the north. You had fascism in Southern Korea and South Korea for many, many years. Now it's moving toward something like, hooray for us, the United States, capitalist democracy, whatever that means. What would it have been like if they'd been just left to themselves? And ask that question now of Iraq. People say we can't leave.
Oh, yeah?
Because there'll be a civil war. There certainly will be. What's going to be more damaging to the Iraqis, that civil war or us staying there and then a civil war? What kind of civil war then, we don't know. What's going to be worse for the Iraqis? And why in hell should we decide? Why can't we let them decide? Why couldn't we let the Koreans decide? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a kind of arrogance in all of this, you understand? The United States, and we put this in terms of, well, we're doing this for bumpity-bumpity-bumpity-bump. Freedom, democracy, whatever the hell we want. And freedom and democracy is usually what we're talking about. But the people who talk about that way are people who don't believe in either freedom or democracy for the people in the United States. They believe in plutocracy for the United States and free enterprise by monopoly power and so on and so on. This is all bullshit. I mean, you and I and many of the people who innocently support the ideas of freedom and democracy for the rest of the world may indeed believe in freedom and democracy. Although if we're average Americans, we don't know what the hell we mean by democracy. We mean by democracy voting. We don't mean by democracy social democracy. We don't mean economic democracy. We mean what we call political democracy. It means you can vote for people who have been bought and sold by the people who have all the money. That's what we mean by democracy. By democracy, we don't mean one person, one unit of power. That's what it's supposed to mean. We mean one person, one vote, so long as it's since the 1960s, for people who aren't white, and since the 1920s for people who aren't men, because women didn't have the right to vote until 80 years ago or so. Blacks didn't have the right to vote in the South until 40 years ago or so, and so on. So it's a bunch of bullshit. It always has been. And people who see that now, there's still many, 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 who knows how many, men who don't think women should be voting, and many whites who don't think blacks should be voting. We don't believe in democracy at all, most of us, if you mean by democracy. Equality of power, do all of us mean that by it? I mean that by it. Most of you mean by that. Do all of you mean that by democracy? Equality of power? I doubt it. Freedom? Bullshit. In any case, Korea has been a tragedy that can never be reversed for Korea, for Koreans. In some degree, the Soviet Union is responsible. But I've always believed that responsibility falls at the door of those who have power. We had much, much more power than the Soviet Union had in 1949, 1950, 51. Much, much more power. And we were ready. Our commander-in-chief, Douglas MacArthur, whom I knew during World War II, just a piece of shit. I knew him. Douglas MacArthur wanted us to go into China, wanted us to use the atomic bomb on China. Douglas MacArthur wanted, and he came back and Congress welcomed him. And he ran for president of the United States. And he's still a hero to many people. He was a piece of shit. Have I told you this story? I'm going to tell you this story about Dougie and me. Big Doug and Little Doug. One of the stories. I was a pilot during the war.
He wasn't as tall as you,
was he?
Huh? Was he as tall as you?
No, but he was bigger than me, you know. So he had more power. I would never have any strength. I was a pilot, but at one point during the war in the Pacific, I had to go with the infantry on an invasion. And we were going on an invasion, 3,000 of us, on a little place sticking out from New Guinea called New Britain, not so little, a couple hundred miles or more. It was a diversionary landing to take attention from a big landing that was going to take place later on. And they wanted to send a pilot along because this being jungle warfare there. We were bombing our own troops, and our own troops were shooting us as we came in, because when you're in jungle warfare, especially the low-level stuff in which my outfit was doing, nobody knew who was who, you know. So they wanted a pilot to go along and talk the planes in and, as they were coming in on the radio, and these were my own outfit, and also have put some kind of smoke around the target so that our planes would not bomb our own people. So I had to go along on this thing, and we had to leave from eastern New Guinea, get in some craft that were half the width of this room and not from here to where Francis is, about 20 feet long. And we got on these things to go about 200 miles in the sea overnight to go make this landing. And the day that we were going to do it, the morning we were going to do it, we were getting ready to take off. Maybe I told you this story before.
No.
The war we were going to take off, as we were getting ready to get into our landing craft, LCT somethings or others, and there were about 20, 25 of us, that is to say these little boats, 3,000 of us all together, and some went some other way. Just as we were going to get into them and take off at 6 o'clock in the morning, Duke MacArthur shows up with his staff, maybe a half a dozen guys, and some journalists. MacArthur shows up. This is in the middle, if I may say so, of a war, okay? So MacArthur shows up, and he and two of his staff people get onto one of these little craft, things that have, thing goes down like that. They get on. It backs out. I'm telling you the truth. I saw this. I was there. It backs out, da-da-da-da-da-da, maybe 50 yards. Then it comes in again, and the photographers are taking the picture of MacArthur landing with us, you understand?
Oh,
and that
God.
Picture I saw 6 months later on the cover of Life magazine,
oh,
MacArthur landing with the troops. You understand? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes on.
He and Bush.
Huh? Yeah, Bush is with his bulging thing and all this stuff and so on. And so on, but that's as much as I want. I want to just turn to Vietnam for a minute or two and then go to Iraq. Yes?
Didn't MacArthur fire on the World War I veterans that were demonstrating
Pardon? He was in charge of the shooting down of the veterans in Washington, D.C. in 1931, 32. He was just a terrible, 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 terrible human being. Arrogant, stupid.
That the same story you just gave was George Bush Sr. on a
Pardon?
Aircraft carrier in the Pacific.
Pardon?
George Bush Sr., same exact story, aircraft carrier in the Pacific. They flew him in.
Yeah, sure.
The cameras arrived. 2 days later, they staged the event out in front of the ship. Cameras going, rescuing.
Well, anyhow, it's nice, in some sense or another, it's nice to have seen this yourself so that you know it's true. Okay, now, you have to believe me. I don't have to believe me. I know it. Okay, yes.
I read at some point that it was MacArthur who actually made the decision to fire on the veterans.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yes, I wouldn't be surprised. He was not quite human person. On Vietnam, Vietnam is Korea was something where we got involved. There's a whole history of the United States about war, which Williams was looking at, which you ought to read about. But then, with the end of World War II, indeed before the end of World War II, that whole history becomes modified to suit the fact that the United States then is the undisputable most powerful country in the world's history. And then we start the Cold War. And the Cold War is a whole new atmosphere within which we make all kinds of economic, political, cultural, and military decisions. The Korean thing was a Cold War decision. And it was, in some sense or another, when we were freshmen in the college of the Cold War and being hegemonic power. And we moved in there because of was in some sense or another the first semi-major issue between the Soviet Union and the United States that had to be decided in some way or another. And, of course, both countries went mad and did the wrong thing to the damage of the Korean. Vietnam was something different. But Iraq is something different still. We had to go into Iraq, okay? We didn't have to go into Vietnam. We went into Vietnam because of what was going on for the United States in Europe. We went into Vietnam for the French. Again, I was a witness, okay? You probably think, this guy Dow is full of shit. He's a liar and on top of everything else. But I was in Manila in 1945, just waiting to go home. The war had ended. Okay, I'll say one other thing before that. Because when the war was the last year and a half or so of the war, as a pilot, I was in charge of air sea rescue for my outfit. Okay, and because of that, we were located in the Philippines, and we were doing rescue missions for not just our own bomb group, but anything that happened to be on the scene, on the horizon, so to speak. We were taking care of or involved with rescue missions, not just Okinawa, et cetera, but also over the South Sea, South China Sea, and Vietnam once in a while, because some of our planes would have to land over there in order, because they couldn't get back after a bombing mission. So I was in touch with the people who were doing the rescue stuff in Vietnam. And most of it was in the north. And many of the people we were working with were North Vietnamese. They were what became Viet Minh people, were called Viet Minh people. And those people, mostly men, not entirely men, who were trying to get U.S. and other allied people out of the British, in some cases, out of the Japanese territory, because Vietnam was by that time ruled by the Japanese. Those people, those rescue people. And we had them in the Philippines, we had them in Formosa, which is now Taiwan, we had them all over the place. Native people, you understand, who cooperated with us in complicated kinds of things. And we had people working in Vietnam, and they were cooperating, they were working with the predecessor of the CIA, the OSS. The OSS was working in Vietnam also during the war. It was working for U.S. purposes because the war was against Japan, and Japan was occupying, and so on and so on. And so the OSS and the Vietnamese revolutionaries were working together to rescue. And at some point, Franklin Delano Roosevelt responded to an inquiry or a request by Ho Chi Minh to make an agreement, which FDR made with the North, with Ho Chi Minh, that after World War II, after the defeat of the Japanese, Indochina would move toward independence, including, of course, Vietnam. Okay? That was in 1944. And I know about that. As it happens, in 1945, the war was over. I was in Manila waiting to go home. I was a captain. I could walk around any place I wanted to do, and I could get, I had some ability to talk to whomever I wished and so on. I was down at the docks. I go down to the docks in San Francisco. I like the docks. Okay, I'm a San Francisco boy. So I was down at the docks, and there's a ship being loaded. A merchant marine, U.S. merchant marine ship being loaded. I saw this. Being loaded with soldiers wearing American uniforms. But they were not American soldiers. This is in, the war is still going on, okay? As, I mean, the war is over, but we're still waiting. These were Dutch and British soldiers who had been prisoners of the Japanese. They were freed, and they were given uniforms and sent to Haiphong to hold the fort for the French. At the very same time, and this is in Marion Young's secret book on Vietnam, the best thing written on it, Marilyn Young. Her book is called Vietnam 1945 to 1990. At the very same time, in France, Le Havre, 13 U.S. ships were being loaded with French soldiers to go to Vietnam. And the deal was made. The deal was made by Mr. Truman, who was then President of the United States, that we would do that and the French would go along with what we wanted for Europe, which they didn't want to do. The French have always been, when I say always, I mean in this century, past century, led by de Gaulle, always been against having the United States have any power whatsoever in Europe. Not for nice reasons. The French wanted that power. Remember Napoleon? He was a Frenchman of sorts, and so on. So when we went into Vietnam, we went in first that way, but we didn't think we were going in. And then we went in another way, and we didn't think we were going in. What we did was to finance and arm the French in the struggle against Ho Chi Minh from 1945 until 1954 when they lost at Dien Bien Phu. That was an American U.S. finance war from beginning to end. Okay, so when that was lost, already we were involved. So from that time on, we were, so to speak, picking up the pieces until we became part of the pieces ourselves. We just got in there, so to speak, by accident. We had no, there was no strategic reason for it. There was no resource reason for it. I wrote a long piece about this during the war, saying that Vietnam is not none of our business, no matter what you look at.
How did Truman get around Roosevelt's agreement?
He was President of the United States. He became President of the United States.
So he felt he didn't need to honor
it. He didn't honor it. Truman was not a nice man. So that's what happened. We just kept going and going and going. So that by the time you get to 1954, the French have been beaten. We're sort of picking up the pieces. Then we go through all this nonsense of free elections and so on, on democracy for South Vietnamese. And so on. And it becomes something like a very different kind of a thing of Iraq, but very, very similar in the sense that the United States is there with an increasing number of troops as time goes on, increasingly involved militarily, always involved financially, always involved politically, and so on, until in some sense or another, we become, we're there, we're glued into it, and so on. It was sort of something like an accident, something like, not quite. But Iraq was nothing like an accident. Iraq is something very, very different. It has to do with two things, either one of which is sufficient One is strategic location. The other is oil. And it's very difficult to divide those, to separate those two things. The best book on the subject is written by a guy, a Bay Area guy, named Larry Everest, called Oil, Power, and Empire. They probably have it here. Very sane, calm discussion of the whole thing from beginning to end. Goes back into good, a lot of good Middle Eastern history and so on. I reviewed it in a monthly review a year or so ago, 6 months or so. Oil is, I don't have to tell you people how important oil is and how important the Middle East is to oil. And the United States has been in the Middle East up to its nose for 50 years now, for one reason at all. I mean, it has been involved up to its ears in Israel for one reason at all. And that was the same thing, oil and strategic location. Then the strategic location had to do with the Cold War and the Soviet Union. Now it has to do with China and the Middle East and everything else. I mean, it's just now everything is all mixed up together. But there's no question at all, no matter what your politics are, no matter who you are, where you are, what your country is, oil is going to dominate everything over the next century. Because we're really literally running out of it, as we are necessarily, as this system goes, using more and more of it per capita. As population rises, it's more and more per capita, even though if the population were steady, and it isn't, it would be much more than that. It's just extraordinary, because we're an absolutely insane world in terms of oil. So we're trying to capture that oil. We will never get out of there. And we can't stay. We can't stay because it is Vietnam, again, a quagmire. We can't leave. Just a second. We can't leave, and yet we can't stay. That is to say, the situation is unpredictable now. All you know is it's insane. We got in there for the wrong reasons, which were the right reasons as far as the White House and the American economy is concerned. We have taken the largest step that has been taken in the past century, toward developing a terrorist army in Iraq. That's our product. We did it. We have made Iraq a training place for terrorists from all over the world, but mostly from the Middle East and Central Asia. Can't get out. And yet, if Iraq is like Vietnam, we must get out. But try to brush your memories back into being about Vietnam. There was a very strong Vietnam anti-war movement. You all know that. Very, very, very strong. But it never would have ended the war. It couldn't have ended the war, no matter what. What ended the war was a combination of other things. One was what was happening amongst the armed forces in Vietnam. You all will know what the word fragging means. Fragging was not a couple of guys doing this. Fragging was an institution, okay? But quite apart from that, the United States is in a position where it cannot provide the forces for that war, and at the same time, it cannot leave. The support for the war is dwindling, and it's going to dwindle at an accelerating rate. As the belief in it, as the costs of it increase. Not because we've lost, my goodness, how terrible, and it is too bad, 1,700 and so on, soldiers. I'm very sorry about those soldiers getting killed. I know what that's like. I was a soldier. But 1,700, let's say it's 2,700, versus the Iraqis have been killed. I mean, the American people are not going to be... It's interesting in a certain sense that people might get excited about the fact in this country that 1,730 American soldiers have been killed, as though that were a great tragedy. It is a great tragedy to those who were killed and their families. But we don't even, the Pentagon officially does not keep count of the Iraqis killed. Officially, they won't. Of course, they have some idea. But Lancet, the British magazine, medical magazine, has made its estimate over 100,000 Iraqis killed. To say nothing of the lives ruined of what's going on socioeconomically, and the whole thing, what's going to go on forever now in that country. It's another Korea. Whether it turns out this way, that way, it's another Korea. The future is damned by that war. But we're not going to get out, and we can't stay. We are going to get out, but we can't. It's that kind of a, that's what you mean by a quagmire. And now what we have is a different world from Vietnam. It's a different world in more than one way. It's a different world within the United States. Whatever was wrong with the population, with the people of the United States in the 60s with respect to the Vietnam War and so much else, it looks like heaven compared with now. Because the government was, in some sense, even under Nixon, the Congress, even in that period, the state legislatures, the city governments were all models of political democracy compared with now. The corruption was rife in the 1960s. Now it's the name of the game. It's absolutely, the corruption is now political corruption. And the reason I talk about it is because it's become almost impossible to get anyone in office, for anyone to get in office unless that person has millions of dollars of dirty money behind it. It's almost impossible. And this has been something that's been brought about, or facilitated, I should say, made almost irreversible by the media, because the media costs so much and they have so much of an impact. So that we have a... Now, this, I'm not saying this is... I'm not saying this saying we have to be hopeless about this. I'm saying everything has changed. Because the media also offer opportunities, as you know, through the internet and so on and so on and so on. But we've got a situation in which the people of today, however inattentive they were in the 60s, I'm talking about not just students, but the people, however inattentive they were in the 60s, they were very attentive compared with today. Because today, consumerism has taken people's attention and put it on department stores and Walmart and cash registers and television ads and so on and so on. Much, much more, qualitatively more than anything in the past. So it's a time in which the disasters of Iraq will not have an echo as noticeable now as they would have had in the 1960s. I think there is a population, adult and young, or I should say young adults and older adults, really bothered, angry, worried, scared about what's going on in Iraq and at home. But we don't know how to deal with it. And as a couple of you know in here, as I've tried to say, we're going to spend the last two meetings here talking about what we can do, how we can do it. And that doesn't mean I'm going to do the talking. It means we're going to do the talking. So I don't want to talk about that tonight. All I want to say is that when I said the Vietnam War wasn't brought to an end by the anti-war movement, all that the anti-war movement did, and it did a lot, was to make it more and more difficult for the United States to act, shall we say, with the kind of indiscretion it would have chosen to act with. That Nixon would have gone. What ended the war was Nixon having to get out of office. That's what ended the war. If he had stayed in, and this is in X. Ellsberg's Secrets book also, he was ready to use the atomic bomb. He was not going to be defeated. That's the kind of nation we are. And what were we there for? Some kind of a raw, rotten deal we made with the French. Originally, that's what got us there. Not resources. Not strategic location. Nothing like that.
How close is Bush to using the atomic bomb?
Who?
Bush.
I don't think he would do that because it would be the end of the world. I mean, it's possible that Bush and his advisors don't know how to spell end of the world. But see, the problem with nuclear warfare is that there are other countries that have nuclear bombs who have some reason, perhaps not sufficient reason, but enough reason to think if they're going to use it, if Bush is going to drop the bomb on Iraq, he may well drop it on us also, because he will think that we might use our bombs against him. In other words, you have to get this kind of reasoning that we know what's going on around Cuba. Okay? There is a book about Cuba in which there are three represented voices. One is McNamara, one is from Cuba, and one is from the Soviet Union. And what was the Soviet Union? And they agreed what they all thought was going on at the time of the missile crisis, okay? The Cuban crisis. It was just within a hair's width that we were going to use the atomic weapons or that the Russians would. Okay? It was so much ignorance, so much misinformation, so much fear, so much machismo, that they all three agreed that we came this close to a nuclear war over Cuba because of misinformation or lack of information. So the problem, given nuclear weapons, then a China which has them, a Russia which has them, whoever else has them, an India that has them, a Pakistan that probably has them, an Israel that has them, if we use them, if we use one, we have to think, what are all those people going to do? To join the crowd, to defend themselves, to get there first, or whatever. It's like sort of the financial crisis. Don't panic, but panic first. Don't drop the atomic bomb, but drop it first. And if there's any, and of course there's all kinds of intelligence going on about all countries on all countries. So if anything like that's going to happen, it has to be insanity that would provoke it. Insanity and suicidal inclinations, because it would mean the end of the world. The end of the human world, at least. That would be a good thing, I think. All things considered, yes?
I remember, and I don't know what politician it was, but somebody went into Congress who said that back in those days. All I want to be sure of is that the last person alive on Earth is an American.
Well, I wouldn't want... That would be a hell of a fate to be there. I hope it is an American. I hope it's George W. Bush. So let's have some further discussion. Yes?
Just a second. I forget the figures, but I think Chalmers Johnson says we have bases in 117 countries now.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your thesis about the two reasons, that notion whether the long-term goal is actually to have bases in Iraq, so we don't have to be in Saudi Arabia, for example.
Well, in the first place, as long as you bring that up, the strategic importance that I was talking about, which is very important, even if there were no oil, and there is that the United States counted on Israel for very, very long. And the United States allowed Israel to have a secret nuclear weapon, which is no longer a secret. And the guy who brought out the secret is in prison in Israel. If we go to war against Iran, for example, it will be the Israelis who drop the bombs of one sort or another, probably not nuclear, on Iran. There are our person there. But Israel itself is in a state of fragility. I mean, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, internal conflict, is something that has, in ways that are difficult to discuss, weakened Israel as an ally. Okay, I mean, they've got enough problems on their hands. That's one of the reasons that we want to see probably the only reason the United States wants to see the Israeli conflict resolved with the Palestinians, so that we can have and they're never going to resolve it. It can't be resolved. Now, it's gone too far. So we've lost that as our linchpin in the Middle East. And Saudi Arabia is in turmoil. It doesn't show very much, but it will show very soon. Okay? So there we go. We got Saudi Arabia, Israel, Iran, Afghanistan, what do we got? You know, so we got to have Iraq, and we got to have an excuse to have Iraq. So we got it. But we also have the excuse of oil. I mean, look what's happening with oil. This is the hell with whether you're an environmentalist or not. You know, as far as I'm concerned, you should make automobiles illegal, along with lots of other things that use carboniferous stuff.